Notes from America is supported by Future Hindsight, an award-winning podcast that shares big ideas about participating in American democracy, beyond voting, but short of running for office. Join host Mila Atmos for stimulating and incisive conversations with citizen changemakers on topics ranging from gerrymandering, policing equity, and voting rights. In this election year, Future Hindsight offers an unaffiliated perspective into what's at stake and how citizens can make an impact at the local, state, and national level. You'll always come away with something hopeful. Tune in every Thursday to get engaged and stay engaged.
Listener supported, WNYC Studios.
How do we know when it's too late? When our democracy is really past its tipping point and can't keep itself up? Thomas Edsel, the veteran political journalist and New York Times contributor, has been putting this question to political scientists, and the findings are alarming. Coming up on the United States of Anxiety, we'll talk with him, we'll look ahead at a pivotal political year, and we'll take your calls. So tell us, how worried are you? Like, really, are you genuinely concerned about the health of our democracy, or is it just more political background noise? The next installment of our ongoing look at the state of our digital town square.
There's a societal responsibility for all of us to be talking about this more, not just blaming companies or politicians, but like, why is it that we, as everyone, are like this on the internet?
From a scale of 1 to 10, how anxious are you about the state of American democracy moving forward past 2024?
I don't know, kind of 6, 7?
I'm gonna say 6, because everybody has their own opinion, and it's okay to respect everyone, but I feel that we are giving too much space to everyone.
Probably 4. Okay. I think about it from time to time, but it's not always in the front of my mind.
Like a 5, because I just choose a little bit ignorance is bliss, but I definitely don't think that we're in a good place with it.
I'd say 7. I'm really concerned about the polarization of our communities and how we're not able to compromise because people are like, no, you're my enemy, so I'm not even going to listen to you. And so how can we possibly imagine people on the Congress floor to be doing anything different? Because that's what we're doing on our individual levels.
Welcome to the show. I'm Kai Wright, and let me start with the opening words President Biden offered in his address to the nation on January 6th.
Madam Vice President, my fellow Americans, to state the obvious, 1 year ago today, in this sacred place, democracy was attacked, simply attacked. The will of the people was under assault. The Constitution, our Constitution, faced the gravest of threats. Outnumbered in the face of a brutal attack, the Capitol Police, the D.C. Metropolitan Police Department, the National Guard, and other brave law enforcement officials saved the rule of law. Our democracy held. We, the people, endured. We, the people, prevail. For the first time in our history, a president had not just lost an election, he tried to prevent the peaceful transfer of power as a violent mob breached the Capitol. But they failed. They failed. And on this day of remembrance, we must make sure that such attack never, never happens again.
I don't know. I guess in the most literal sense, the attack last January failed. But in almost every other way, it's tough for me to share the president's certainty about how that day concluded and about all that's happened since. But then it's become commonplace to do this, right? To kind of rhetorically wring one's hands about the state of our politics. And honestly, I'm not at all clear how much urgency people who don't do politics feel about the state of our democracy. So I want to hear from you. And let's start with the question you heard our producer, Regina DeHeer, asking people out in the streets over this past week. On a scale of 1 to 10, how anxious are you about the fate of democracy itself in this country? And to put some boundaries on it, let's say the fate of the democracy past the 2024 presidential election. How anxious are you about whether we'll have a functioning democracy after that point? Rank yourself on a scale of 1 to 10 and tell me why. And as we take your calls, I'm joined by someone who has been watching our politics and our democracy for many years. Thomas Edsel writes a weekly column for the New York Times about politics, demographics, and inequality. And in a couple of columns just before the new year, he interviewed a number of political scientists about the state of our democracy. He joins me now to talk about what he heard and to take your questions. Thomas, thanks for coming on.
In terms of a hard number, I would say 7.5 would be my level of concern.
You're at 7.5.
7.5. It's significant, but not totally fatally committed to the idea that we're on the verge of collapse. Okay. But it is a dangerous position and a delicate one. And the real issue is that there is a significant group, it's a minority, but a significant group who really do not support the basic norms of democracy. Roughly 30% of the electorate, almost all Republicans who see the election as stolen and who are prepared to support policies that really endanger the ability of election officials to conduct fair and open contests for seats from the presidency down to state legislative seats. And they're trying to take over the election administration machinery and turn those powers over to state legislatures, especially in swing states with Republican legislatures. So the Republicans would have the power to determine who won an election as opposed to a theoretically less biased administrator. These are significant challenges to democracy and could result in a corrupt election outcome as soon as this year, 2022, or more problematically in 2024, if there were a close election for the presidency and the election was ultimately decided, the Electoral College votes were decided by biased decisions in Republican-controlled state legislatures. So there's a significant danger to the operation of democracy.
So your 7.5 has you not at complete collapse of the idea of democracy, but just but the operation of it being pretty gummed up.
Yes.
And I want to talk a little bit about the why that you spelled out in your column before the new year. You've been reading and interviewing political scientists and sociologists, and you summed it up in that column, and it had the headline, it was an alarming headline, how to tell when your country is past the point of no return. And one sociologist you spoke with, Michael Macy at Cornell University, he said to you, and I'm going to quote it, "Unlike the threat to democracy posed by a military coup, the threat posed by authoritarian populism is incremental. If the water temperature increases only 1 degree per hour, it may take a while before you notice it is too hot, and by that time, it is too late. We might be better off if we faced an armed insurrection." And I want you to say more about that, because honestly, for at least a couple of years now, for me, the whole democracy conversation has felt quite similar to the climate discussion in that there's this inexorable march toward a disaster that is actually happening quite fast, but that people are really only experiencing it incrementally. That seems like what Michael Macy is talking about. Can you say more about that?
I think, one, I agree with you. Two, it is a situation where what is really surprising to me is how little opposition to these trends has emerged from the center and from the left. It is, as I think he described, sort of like the frog in a pot of water that's slowly boiling, and suddenly he's going to be boiled without knowing it. For example, what really strikes me is that there is no, for example, student protest going on about all this. That here is something that would seem to be very attractive, at least I'm an old man now, but in my youth, the Vietnam War, the civil rights movement, the women's rights movement, all provoked real assertions of concern on the campus and on marches and marches on Washington, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Here's one that it seems to me to be equally or more important, perhaps, because it encompasses everything, the whole democratic system. And it includes a good adversary, Donald Trump, and a Republican Party that's been taken over by people who are basically authoritarian. It's sort of an ideal mechanism or an ideal adversary to choose. But this has not happened on the campus, much less in the broader public, in the same way that the civil rights movement and the Vietnam War, all those things produced real outcries. We have a situation of, let's say, at least equal proportion, but no action. And as you say, the climate situation is similar. But this democracy thing is something you would think would be felt. Students don't like to be bossed around. They do not like to be held under authoritarian circumstances.
And well, I'll say that, you know, next week we are, in fact, going to talk with a student who has been hunger striking on behalf of the voting rights legislation in Congress. And so there's some out there. This is some students in Arizona. So stay tuned next week, dear listeners, to hear what they have to say. But I agree. Part of the premise of tonight's show is that it seems to me that there's a gap between what feels so urgent and how urgent this feels in everybody's lives. And so we've got a ton of callers already. And so let's hear from some of them as we talk through your column, Thomas, to just see what that, to see where people are landing. Let's go to Andy in Westchester. Andy, welcome to the show.
Hey, Kai. Hey, Mr. Edsel, thanks for having me.
Sure.
So as I mentioned to your screener, just before I give you my rating, I do think a lot of this is driven by distraction, right? So back in the day, right, Vietnam War and so forth, there wasn't the internet. There wasn't the sheer amount of noise and distraction, and everyone can kind of create their own reality. So it's, what I see is I'm a 9.5, you know, in the scale of concern. I'm also already coming to terms with it, right? There's going to be a sweep in 2022. Trump is absolutely going to be the president in 2024, to my dismay. If I don't accept this, I'm going to lose my mind and probably end up in the hospital. So part of it is just health and acceptance. It's going to happen. And by the time, I think the only thing that's really going to activate people is going to be when it really starts to impact them, right? They start to see that, wow, we are a minority rural country and there's no off-ramp. And so it's going to hit a fever pitch. Finally, you'll have maybe 10 years, 15 years. I think you're going to have people rise up. There's going to be more of what you saw in, you know, January in January, but it's going to be on the other side, and it's going to be people finally realizing what's been taken away. And it's just going to take a long time, unfortunately, to get to that point.
10 years is a long time. Thank you, Andy. Let's go to Carol in the West Village. Carol, welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you.
Where are you on a scale of 1 to 10? Where would you put yourself?
Oh, I would put myself around a 5. And I think that it's just a small point to talk about the elections. I think there is such despair over loss of jobs, scarcity of low-income housing, difficulties with rent and mortgage loss from 2008, and loss of job. There's so much suffering going on that the peak is coming through these public things like elections. But yes, I agree that a minority country is difficult to fathom. I agree that the Supreme Court deciding on who's to be president at the election that happened, you know, what, 3 ago, is a hard thing to take, that it is making people feel like they have no voice.
But you're only out of 5. You would say, you know, this is halfway to dire in terms of our democracy.
Yeah, I think it's a process. I think when people can afford to put their lives at risk in order to have their political voice be heard, that it will become more dire. I don't think it's dire just because guns were in the Capitol. I think, you know, I lived through the 60s. There has to be an enormous amount of loss before people will stand up and be heard. And there's a lot of politicians and corporate policymakers that have to listen to the people. So it will be a long process. That's why I give it a 5.
Thank you, Carol. Thomas, before we go to a break and get and do some more calls, I mean, speaking of process, so you talked to the political scientists again in this column, and one of the most striking studies you discussed, to me at least, is one that was published in December, 5 political scientists who described a feedback loop that can occur inside a political party and that eventually becomes irreversible. Can you try to explain what they mean by this feedback loop and what its consequences are for the Republican Party?
Well, you really can see it in the Republican Party, where the first feed, in a sense, is Trump declaring that he won the election and that the election was stolen. Then the feedback comes from millions of his supporters actually agreeing with that and willing to accept the premise that this is true. And then Trump then echoes it further, and the two feed on each other and build up a substantial constituency, and by that about, say, left 30% of all voters and a majority of Republican voters, that's based on a disproven conspiracy. That's the kind of process, I don't mean to exaggerate this too much, but when you see authoritarian governments taking place, including in Germany in the early 1930s, it was a minority faction that pushed Adolf Hitler into his position of power, and the sort of slow accession to that process by the establishment. And the problem is that Republicans are now using semi-legal and still not proven by judiciary ruling to be illegal procedures in state legislatures and other places, that then if they come to fruition in 2024, they all have sort of evolved and taken place where there's very little feedback going on to the center and to the left, whereas the right is feeding itself. And then at some juncture, this 30% can then add the rest of Republicans and then some people who just don't pay attention to politics and so on and so forth, and it accumulates into what is then a very dangerous circumstance. I don't think the argument that was made a little earlier that people are suffering too much now. People were suffering back in 1960s. The average level of the cost of living and so forth, things were worse back then for people, and especially for minorities, but also for poor whites back then than they are now. I thought the other caller had a good point about how many people are exercising their political views by just saying so on Twitter, and that seems to satisfy a lot of needs without having much effect. That there's sort of a rhetorical satisfaction in declaring, yes, I'm against this, but then nothing to really follow up and to change what's taking place. And it may be that the internet has really undermined the kind of mass protest or mass challenging to the right that's necessary at this point.
Well, I mean, certainly there has been a lot of hand-wringing about the internet and what it has done to our politics. We'll talk about that a little later in the show too. But I also just wonder about the actual feedback loop inside the Republican Party and the inability of the party to correct its course. That's part of what I'm seeing in that study you cited, which is scary because it's one of two political parties in the country that it would be unable to correct its course at that point. At this point, I mean, is that what you were hearing from them? Is that it literally is past the point of return?
Very likely, and it partly is a system in which all the rewards are for accepting this basic untruth about the Trump stolen election. If you challenge that, if you are a Republican politician, you are very likely to be defeated in a Republican primary the next time you run for re-election. Whereas if you accept it, then you go along to get along. And the main thing that a politician wants is to get re-elected, Democrat, Republican, anybody. But the incentives now on the Republican side have become to accept a delusion and to endorse that delusion in order to preserve your victory in the next election. This is the worst kind of feedback loop. And then you have a huge network of conservative media that basically enforce that incentive system with a vengeance. I mean, Tucker Carlson's making Ted Cruz, right, the past few days, look like a pathetic, it's hard to describe, because Cruz questioned the legitimacy of the insurrectionists at the Capitol, and he's made Cruz publicly apologize in what can only be described as a pathetic exhibition by any politician.
We'll take a break. I'm Kai Wright, and I'm talking with veteran political journalist and New York Times columnist Thomas Edsel about his recent column, How to Tell When Your Country is Past the Point of No Return. We'll be right back to take more of your calls. I want to know where you're at on a scale of 1 to 10 in your concern about our democracy. Stay with us.
Hey everyone, this is Kusha. I'm a producer. A couple weeks ago, we did an episode about Yalda, the celebration that happens during winter solstice. Definitely check it out. So during that episode, we asked you how you were going to celebrate the solstice. One listener, Fran, wrote to us about her plans. Here's what she said. For me, solstice is a turning inward to embrace the long night, rather than celebrating the return of the light. So much in our Western culture, or perhaps even world culture at this point, is to shun the dark and party long and hard. Perhaps my age, 70, has a great deal to do with my choosing the quiet and the dark. I will enjoy a few Zoom gatherings today, so we'll be connected with others too. Thanks, Fran, for that message. We also got a video recording from a listener, Ricardo, who, full disclosure, is a friend of mine. It's late at night, and he's celebrating by safely burning a small fire outside.
There you go, all frustrations consumed in fire. A new year is coming.
Thanks, all of you, for listening and talking to us. And we're hoping that happens even more in 2022. So if you've got something to say, send us a message. Audio, video, written, it's all good. The address is anxiety@wnyc.org. Again, that's anxiety@wnyc.org. Thanks.
Welcome back. This is the United States of Anxiety. I'm Kai Wright, and I'm joined this week by New York Times columnist Thomas Edsel. We're talking about his recent column with the arresting headline, How to Tell When Your Country is Past the Point of No Return. Thomas has been talking to political scientists and sociologists about this question, and the answer that a lot of them have told him, in short, is hyper-partisanship, that our partisan affiliations have trumped all other issues for us. And when party affiliation trumps all other concerns, if you'll pardon the pun, we find ourselves in a difficult situation. So we have one tweet, somebody who said, never mind, I'm at an 11, felt this way since 2000 when Gore conceded to Bush, despite being the victor. I voted for Nader, by the way. The dearth of a viable third party is a big part of our downfall. So that's Stephen Constant. And let's go to Joan in Franklin Lakes. Joan, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
So where would you rank yourself, Joan?
I rank myself at least an 8. And the reason why is based on the Constitution. As citizens, we all should understand the Constitution, but we pledge to the flag specifically, not specifically to the Constitution. Senators and congresspeople have pledged an oath to uphold the Constitution. And what I see, what we all should see, is that the vast majority of the Republicans have broken that oath very consciously. And they're not about to change it. So if they and that party do not support the Constitution, how can we have a democracy?
But I want to ask also, Joan, how personal is this for you? Because so, you know, Thomas and I were talking before the break about just how much energy there is or is not amongst most people outside of people who are political professionals about the state of democracy itself. Set aside electoral politics and which party you're from, but just the idea of democracy. How personal does that feel to you? And do you feel like people in your circle, if you're at 8, that other people are at an 8, or is it background noise to most people?
It's background noise to most people. I can come to tears thinking about it. I participated in a virtual, what do we call it, demonstration on Thursday night. And I also have lived through the 60s and have gone to demonstrations. And as the weather warms up, I will go to more demonstrations on this subject, and I'll try to get my friends to do it as well. We have to go to the streets about it. This is about defending our country.
Thank you, Joan. Let's hear from Spencer in Berkeley Heights, New Jersey. Spencer, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Where would you rank yourself on a 1 to 10 scale?
Between a 7 and an 8, depending upon what news headlines I see.
Okay,
that day.
And why? Why are you at a 7 or 8? Why are you that high?
The things that frustrate me the most these days are a combination of the rhetoric that comes out of the legislative branch, along with the laws and the decisions that come out of both the legislative and the judiciary. It's a situation where it seems almost like a scope creep or a general escalation of things either going way too far to the right or occasionally way too far to the left, although the latter is definitely a minority compared to the former. Some people were talking about how, I believe it was a previous caller, talked about that their anxiety began with Gore losing to Bush. For me, it was the outcome of Citizens United. The premise that, as I believe Romney said, corporations are people too. That right then and there showed me the beginnings of how we could discount the premise of what it means to be a citizen in this country, and that businesses could go ahead and be of more value for the long-term growth of the country than its own citizens. Fast forward that now, a decade, 2 decades later, and we're seeing discussions about, you know, voting rights being suppressed or curtailed. The fact that we had the Supreme Court overturn the Voting Rights Act with the rationale, I believe it was Chief Justice Roberts effectively saying, well, since it's no longer raining, we don't need an umbrella.
They said that racism
and now we're
no
seeing
longer
the
impacts
outcome
our
of
elections. Was the
exactly. So when we have situations like that, you know, most people, ordinary people on the street, they're going ahead and they're looking at these irregularly shaped pieces of cardboard and they can't quite figure out what they all represent. But when you put enough of them down on a table together, you realize it's the foundations of a puzzle. And when it completes, I don't know whether or not any of us are going to like the end resulting picture.
Spencer, I'm going to stop you there for time. Thomas, Spencer says he traces this back to Citizens United. You, in all of your years and years now of watching American politics and American democracy in general, what about you? Where do you think was the turning point? If you said you're at a 7.5 on your concern about the health of our democracy, where would you look back and say this is where things started to turn?
Oh, I think it goes back even farther than that. The whole process that we're in now began in the 1960s, in my view. First with the Civil Rights Act of 1964, which was the first time that Democrats and Republicans became identified, one as the party of racial liberalism, one as the party of racial conservatism. Then there was the split between the parties that grew up over the women's rights movement, particularly the constitutional amendment proposing equal rights for both men and women, which at first was bipartisan, but then became quite partisan. Then there's been the whole culture war issues over the sexual revolution, including matters of gay rights. And then all these have slowly divided the two parties into two very separate camps. And I think things like Citizens United may sound like a stretch, but I would argue, and it's a little too hard to, at any rate, that Citizens United and other developments that we see now are really outgrowths of these separations that began way back when. And it's been an ongoing, what is it, a 50-year process, where, or 55-year process, that's consumed America and become increasingly divisive and has produced this situation where ultimately we have two warring camps where both sides see the other as a hostile enemy, hostile to their values, hostile to their personal lives, to their religious beliefs, to their beliefs and the obligations that men and women have to family and to children. The divide is extraordinarily wide, and the sense of threat, there's this whole concept of threat activation, I think it's called, by political scientists, but one where the very idea of having sort of a Democrat come into a Republican community or vice versa produces a sense of an alien force has entered your world. And this has created this division that is now reaching the point of becoming insuperable, which is why I'm at a 7.5 or so. It's very hard to correct these developments. Neither side wants to go into a negotiation with the other. When that's the circumstance, you don't have a grounds for reducing conflict and trying to achieve consensus.
How do you, I mean, so it, part of what I'm hearing in there and what I've read in your work is that this consensus amongst the political scientists, again, that it is this, just this, the way that partisanship has displaced all other things, and that, you know, your allegiance to your given party, and that this is, according to the political scientists, true for both Republicans and Democrats, that your allegiance to your given party overrides other issues or other thoughts that you might have, that then makes it impossible to stop a party's movement towards extremism. And so my question becomes, and it's a genuine question, is how are we able to separate out the conversation about democracy itself from that partisan conversation? And I struggle with this because I don't have a different framework for it. As we've, you know, we experience our, we access our democracy through the partisan system, and one of the parties has gone down this road. So, I mean, what do you think? How can we separate out these things in the public discourse?
Well, first, I would take a slightly different take. I don't think partisanship has overridden these other differences. I think partisanship has basically encompassed those differences. And you become divided by party on such a wide range of things, your belief in the status of women, your belief in racial equity, your belief in whether in religion or being an atheist, all these things together have become integrated into partisanship, which is what has made polarization so difficult to deal with, because it has become so encompassing of your whole identity. The way people put all kinds of things into their identity as a Democrat, as Republican, that they did not used to do. And that is where, by compromising in those circumstances, you're compromising on your own sense of self, your own sense of purpose, your own sense of who you are and where you are, your identity. It's very hard to do that. There are a lot of experiments going on now of trying to get people to talk together and meet together. And if you have contact with people from the other side, does that lessen your degree of polarization? The problem is that those conversations often take place with people who want to lessen their, right. And the problem is that most people don't want to lessen their hostility to the other.
It's because it's a referendum on your own personal identity. Let's hear from Lauren in the Bronx. Lauren, welcome to the show.
Thank you. My comment is that one of the reasons, or the main reason, that there's no mobilization as there was in the 60s is that there's no leadership of any kind of protest groups. And part of that is because Joe Biden did get the presidency. Had he been denied the presidency, I think he would have seen the people in the streets protesting, but he got it. So I think there needs to be a formulated, specifically focused cause that people can get behind. And I think you would get people marching down. And you did get presidency. Had he been...
Oh, I think we lost Lauren, but I got the point that part of the urgency was lost in Joe Biden's victory. Let's hear from Brian in Harlem. Brian, welcome to the show.
Hey, guys. Can you hear me?
I can hear you. Where would you put yourself on a 1 to 10?
Well, if I have confidence in the Democratic strategy to win the next election, about a 3, but I would say about an 8. Because I don't have any confidence at all. But I do have a semi-solution.
Let's hear it.
Or at least a partial solution. Democrats in Republican states should register as Republicans and vote in Republican primaries.
A mass movement to do so. So you see, you party swapping. Well, if nothing else,
you can, like in Georgia, it's an open primary. So they just vote. They won't even have to change. I think you have to make a choice to vote in either the Democratic or Republican. But, you know, if all of a sudden it's not, and a lot of people hate Trump in the Republican Party, but they kowtow to him because they're afraid of being primaried. If you could remove that fear, you might get less partisanship. You might get centrist Republicans running. But, you know, it would take a lot of people to do it.
Well, Brian, we're going to give you the last word on that one solution, but listen to everybody who we've got a ton of calls about this and we haven't been able to get to all of you. So I want you to send me an email, record what you've got to say and send me an email to anxiety@wnyc.org. We're going to return to this conversation at some length throughout this election year. And Thomas Edsel is a veteran political journalist who writes a weekly column for the New York Times on politics, demographics, and inequality. Thomas, thanks for calling in with us tonight.
My pleasure. Good to talk to you.
And we will talk to you again as well. Okay, so a few weeks ago, we did an experiment in which I asked, which we had all of you look at what kind of political content came up in each of our own sort of YouTube search engines. This is kind of related to the divisiveness that we're talking about here. And we were trying to test out what they call the filter bubble, what lives inside, what we get when we go online inside our filter bubble. But when several of us got some sort of unexpected results, it led me to ask a whole nother question. Is the far right just better than everybody else at getting content in front of us on social media? Up next, we answer that question.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back. This is the United States of Anxiety. I'm Kai Wright. Just before the new year, we began a new inquiry on this show. We're thinking about the ways we all talk and engage and take in new information online. Information about political and social debates, yes, but also about each other and our differences. Can we better understand how the digital town square operates today and how we all show up in it, and thus maybe use it better? Previously, we talked about the so-called filter bubbles that search engines create for us. And we had you do an assignment on YouTube to look at your own filter bubble. Several of us found out that Topher, a pro-Trump rapper, was winning the YouTube search game in our feeds. This is where we make a stand, no more give or take. March around the Capitol, storm the city gates. And that made us ask another question about political content, specifically online, which is just like, is the right just better at getting content in front of us? And our senior digital producer, Kusha Navinar, has been thinking about that question and has come back with some more information. Hey, Kusha, what you got for us?
Well, you know the drill. I started with one question and it turned into 100, but there's a story.
Okay.
We have to go back to April of 2020 and we have to go on Twitter.
All right.
So, Kai, you've got a Twitter account. Obviously, lots of political content on there.
Indeed.
So, for a while, Twitter has been asking whether its algorithm amplifies that political content you see.
Mm-hmm.
And they have actually put action to words. Two Aprils ago, they helped launch this huge study to explore that very question.
Wow.
And, Kai, this is really a big deal. Just the fact that they've even done this study is special. I actually spoke with the reporter who first wrote about it, Anna Kramer from Protocol.
It's extremely unique in the social media space to have a team that is so public about the effort to examine the ethics, the transparency, the accountability behind the machine learning algorithms that inform how social media works. And that study question exists because there's a lot of surmising out in the world about, you know, some people say that conservatives are oppressed on social media or that the political left gets a bonus point on social media. Those kinds of questions sort of flutter about in the zeitgeist, and this was intended to help begin to answer that question for Twitter specifically.
Yeah, that actually does sound like an impressive study. What does it actually do? How's it work?
So again, the goal was to find out how Twitter's algorithm might amplify political content from politicians or media outlets.
Mm-hmm.
And if there's any difference in how much amplification happens based on whether the content comes from the left or the right. So between April and August of 2020, these researchers look at millions of tweets that fall under one of two categories. One is tweets from elected officials across 7 countries, including the U.S., and two is tweets with links to news articles in the U.S.
So you got elected officials and media.
Exactly. And they compare how those tweets get amplified among millions of users who have a personalized timeline versus millions of users who don't have a personalized timeline. And Kai, do you know what I'm talking about here?
Yeah, I do. I kind of like it on my own feed, right? It's just like right there on your homepage, and you can look at either tweets in real time, or you can switch over and look at what the algorithm says you should be looking at.
Yeah, exactly. Here's how Anna describes it.
So as a journalist, for example, when I use Twitter, I do it both ways all the time. So the algorithmic curation of the feed, this is like a setting you can toggle on your homepage, will allow Twitter to decide for me what I should see first based on a complex series of machine learning designs that interact with one another. Or I can toggle it, and what I see is based on when it was tweeted. So I see the most recent thing first, I see the thing that was posted 10 seconds before that, et cetera, all the way down. And any person can switch between those two timelines whenever they would like. And so for Twitter, it's very, very easy to go and compare, okay, what do you see when, if you have your version of your feed is chronological versus your version is algorithmic.
So that's neat. So like in the study, the accounts without that personalized feed, I guess, then become the control group, right?
Right. And so that way you get a peek into how the personalized algorithm might amplify different types of content differently.
Okay. So what did they find?
Two big findings. First, tweets from elected officials, left or right, get some boost with the algorithm.
Right, so we immediately know that for some reason, whether it's the users or the algorithm, political content performs well online. The second finding is that both content from right-leaning political officials, as well as content from outlets that are designated to be right-leaning, also performs better in terms of engagement, in terms of how often people see it on the Twitter algorithmic timeline compared to left-leaning content.
Okay, so let's pause and digest, because that's a lot. There's two big findings. Political content from elected officials, left and right, gets some boost with the Twitter algorithm. And the second big finding, that content from the right gets a higher amplification compared to the left. That's where it starts. Because according to Anna, there's this whole other next line of questioning that this study didn't try to answer, but that is just as interesting of a set of takeaways.
What's extremely critical here, and what we haven't gotten into, though, is that this study examines what happens, not why it happens. And the reason for doing this is because it's extremely difficult to figure out whether you see content more because the algorithm favors it, or whether the user favors the content more, in turn teaching the algorithm to show it what it favors. And this is incredible. It's like the most important thing you can understand about how algorithms work, is you need to figure out if the way the algorithm is designed creates a bias that doesn't already exist, or whether it essentially has users decide what's interesting and then reinforces what's interesting for them.
And to be clear, Kai, the study doesn't try to answer why the right might get more amplification. I mean, what Anna is saying is crucial here. We don't know the why, but we definitely talked about some theoreticals because they do exist. They're out there.
So when we talk about algorithmic amplification, all we mean is that the average person is probably going to see or interact with more right-leaning content. The why is the part that there's so many possibilities. Perhaps there are more people who are online who are right-leaning. As somebody who experiences a lot of left-leaning Twitter, that's hard to believe, but that could be a possibility. It's also entirely possible that right-leaning figures post content that is just more engaging than left-leaning figures to the average user. It's very clear that content that is inflammatory in some way performs better, whether you blame an algorithm or other people for it. Right. And there's other research out there that does suggest that right-leaning politicians and political parties are much better at generating that content. It's also just about being internet savvy and using the internet well. If you look at the way Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez uses Instagram and Twitter, it creates extremely high levels of engagement because she's very comfortable. And she understands how the people who vote for her and engage with her actually use the platform. And you could say the same thing about the way Donald Trump used Twitter. Right. And so I think on an individual level, it becomes even more clear that skill at understanding the way people interact with social media directly informs what you see and how you interact with it. And so I think you could probably say with confidence that to some extent, right-leaning political actors are just better at this. What you do with that information is a much harder question.
Those are interesting theories and maybe alarming ones, because if people making extreme right-wing content are better at it, that has huge social implications, and they do seem to be better at it. It's getting around more.
Well, that's a theory, but to be clear, since a lot of people might actually be wondering about how this all applies to extreme ideologies, this study didn't find that extreme ideologies get amplified more than mainstream ones. And again, it's not trying to answer the why. It's just here's the data that we found. And in terms of that data, what we're talking about here is what we call group effects. So you can't apply these findings to individual accounts. The study's looking at trends, not, you know, your individual Twitter account.
Got it. But nonetheless, what does this mean for me as an individual when I go on Twitter?
Yeah, absolutely. We talk a lot about how tech companies and policies need to change, and absolutely, there's so much to explore there. But we also have to start talking about ourselves. I mean, when we are trying to point out what's wrong, can you consider the thumb instead of only the finger?
The thumb.
Can you look at yourself, basically.
Oh, you're going grade school on us, Kusha.
You know, Kai, this is making me think how this is bigger than politics. You remember, In our very first episode, we talked about the internet is our town square, right?
Right.
This is our third installment of the segment, and I'm already seeing a pattern emerge with how we interact on that town square. Every expert we've talked to so far has said some version of, you can't just blame the algorithm or the company. It's way more complicated than that. And that, again, is one takeaway I got talking to Anna.
There's a social, societal responsibility for all of us to be talking about this more, not just blaming companies or politicians, but like, why is it that we, as everyone, are like this on the internet? And what can we be doing better? Maybe it's something, maybe you need to be studying this in elementary school. This is how you use social media, or your parents need to be teaching you, but there's something here we're not doing.
This is a lot what Anna's talking about to me. There's no big fix coming from somebody else, at least not yet. And so we also need to learn how to use these tools more effectively and how to be more literate with the technology that we use every single day. I mean, we've already seen how that plays out with our political content online. Let's go a little bit bigger. Next time, let's see how we can make other issues like childhood education and how different groups and identities are treated online. What can we learn there with how the internet is affecting our lives? And generally, how can we make life online just a little less crappy?
Thanks, Kusha.
Yeah, thank you.
And of course, we want to hear more from you directly about this whole conversation. Kusha is off and running in his exploration of how we can make the town square of the internet in general, and social media in particular, just a happier and healthier place. So do you have a question? He might be able to answer about that. Send it to us. Record a voice memo on your phone and email it to us at anxiety@wnyc.org. The United States of Anxiety is a production of WNYC Studios. Our theme music was written by Hannes Brown and performed by the Outer Borough Brass Band. Sound design by Jared Paul. Milton Ruiz was at the boards for the live show. Our team also includes Emily Botine, Regina Dahir, Karen Frillman, and Kusha Navadar. And I am Kai Wright. You can keep in touch with me on Twitter at Kai_Wright. And you can find me live next Sunday, 6 p.m. Eastern. Stream it at WNYC.org or tell your smart speaker to play WNYC. Until then, thanks for listening and take care of yourselves.
Notes from America is supported by Future Hindsight, an award-winning podcast that shares big ideas about participating in American democracy, beyond voting, but short of running for office. Join host Mila Atmos for stimulating and incisive conversations with citizen changemakers on topics ranging from gerrymandering, policing equity, and voting rights. In this election year, Future Hindsight offers an unaffiliated perspective into what's at stake and how citizens can make an impact at the local, state, and national level. You'll always come away with something hopeful. Tune in every Thursday to get engaged and stay engaged.